Although Hamlet, Macbeth, Richard III, and King Lear are the best-known leaders in Shakespeare's plays, many scholars and academics count Coriolanus as a favorite. The story follows General Caius Marcius Coriolanus's military victories, his diplomatic failings, his exile, and ultimately his quest for revenge against his own Roman people. Ralph Fiennes is currently starring in a film version of the play that presents it as modern-day wartime tale. It also marks his debut as a director. Coriolanus opens this coming Friday at the Angelica and the Eleanor Boone in Monroe Film Center, and I'm very pleased it has brought Ralph Fiennes back to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Hi.
I've heard that Coriolanus was a favorite of T.S. Eliot and Frank Kermode and some other important literary figures. Why isn't it produced more often? Is it just too difficult to mount?
I think in the theater it's tricky because it's textually it's very dense. The protagonist is extremely confrontational and is required, Coriolanus, in the middle of the play to speak at length in difficult, dense verse in a constant rage, which goes on and on. In fact, Shakespeare has everyone around him saying, please, will you stop? And he actually says, no, take more. And he goes on and on. And I think this barrage of language... it happens other places too in the play, and it starts off with a battle. It's a sort of assault on the ears, possibly. And I think in the theatre it's hard. There's no easy way in, especially an audience finding the point of allegiance with the protagonist.
It also has many different settings. You have to wonder how it played in Shakespeare's time, because this is unlike any other.
I think it barely
Shakespearean
played.
Play.
It's questionable if it played at all. It probably barely played. Maybe. Handful of performances.
So when you were performing this on the stage, were you thinking about how it might be adapted into a film?
Well, yes, because I think underneath all this difficult, actually rather wonderful verse when you look at it, but actually in performance it's a hard thing to pitch. Underneath it all is a very dynamic narrative, it's a great story. I mean, it's a story of political intrigue centered around this high-definition, narcissistic General Coriolanus, who I think Shakespeare positions as someone that you should probably resist, and then very skillfully, with a kind of dramatic high stakes gamble, if you like, we can find ourselves following this guy and actually sympathising with him. And I just felt so much of it could make a film if you were to scrape away a lot of this difficult text. You're left with a narrative that has extremely strong sort of forward momentum.
Well, most of Shakespeare's difficult protagonists have countervailing, counterbalancing
sure.
characters.
Mm.
There's none here. Everybody is a difficult character.
No, there's no. I think that's another reason why it's hard. I think people... people don't know where to put their sense of loyalty in the audience. It's riven with ambivalence as a play. It's many, many questions are being asked, and there's no easy point of empathy.
You said that you felt as if you had unfinished business with the lead role after you performed it on stage.
Mm. Well, again, it's again to do with this problem of you're constantly... We were in a difficult space acoustically, I remember, and the kind of level of rage... I could feel myself battling with the difficult acoustic and it being difficult. I also felt the interior life that I felt I was living through was not transmitting because it's what was being felt in the moments when one wasn't speaking. And I had this instinct that those close-ups of a man watching, listening... I mean, the close-up is the great platform for the actor today. I mean, I think... Theatre thrives on language, essentially, I think. I mean, the written theatre.
And body language.
And body language. But, yes, sure. But the close-up is what defines performance on film, I think, in drama. And I think in terms of all the characters, particularly Coriolanus, the what's not being said could be quite potent on screen.
You've done a lot of Shakespeare in theatre, but isn't this the first Shakespeare you've done on screen, even though your brother actually played Shakespeare at one point?
Yeah, it is. It is. I'd wanted to play Shakespeare on screen, and this emerged. I don't know. It became a kind of obsession, a thing that I couldn't let go of, wanting to play it again. But also I had this idea of what it could be, which John Logan, who wrote the screenplay, was... essential part of realizing this modern day context for it.
Did setting it in modern times allow you to explain some of the complications of the plot more easily through TV newscasts, talk shows, panel interviews? They can serve the same purpose as pages and pages of dialogue.
They can. And also, I think, just the physical arena, the world of it, whether it's a marketplace or someone's home, all these things, I think, on stage often it's done with light or shapes or, you know, suggestion of place. But on film, you can really have the place. And I think that can help it too.
Well, Shakespeare's play begins with a protest demonstration. When you were doing this, some of the things that bear strong similarities, current events like Arab Spring or what's going on in Iraq, already happening?
Well, no, the Arab Spring wasn't. But things that had influenced me as references were earlier uprisings in Athens, or uprisings in Burma and in Paris, and constantly watching what's evolving in Putin's Russia, where protests are put down. I mean, I know recently there's been an unusual sort of extended protest recently in Russia, but before that I was always watching interested whenever people attempted to protest in Russia and in Belarus. The authorities were very, very heavy, very strong on it and quashing any kind of demonstration.
Ukraine as well,
yeah.
Although that's ended in a very weird way, almost Shakespearean way, with the leader of the rebellion winding up in prison. In 1995, Ian McKellen starred in a film version of Richard III, which he set in a 30s fascist world. A few years ago, I saw a production of Macbeth with Patrick Stewart that was set in a kind of Stalinist environment. Why do you think Shakespeare's plays lend themselves to these kinds of treatments?
I think because of the situations that he writes about, people in power, people wanting to be in power, holding on to power. I'm talking about not so much the comedies, perhaps, but things haven't changed. The essential human behavioural pattern that he identifies hasn't really changed. These situations, whether it's in Julius Caesar or Macbeth or the history plays. In fact, when I did Coriolanus, we did it in tandem with Richard II, which is another look at a man trying to hold on to power and being revealed as being totally unequipped for it.
But when you did it on stage, where was it? When was it set?
Richard II?
No.
Coriolanus. Coriolanus was set loosely. It suggested something late 19th century. We had long coats, tunics, but very, very plain, very simply done.
Haven't other actors who directed film versions of Shakespeare's plays, like Kenneth Branagh earlier, Laurence Olivier, tended to make their versions more literal, set them in the time that Shakespeare had set them?
Well,
you could do that with movies.
Shakespeare takes any amount of interpretation. I mean, what's extraordinary is it can be cut, reinterpreted, set to music, and the storyline's taken and all the dialogue completely rewritten. But I'd actually been in a production of Julius Caesar, which was done in modern dress on stage. I loved it. I loved the directness of it. And I just felt I wanted the audience, who was to see this film, to recognize the place that they were in.
My guest is Ray Fiennes, whose new film, Coriolanus, is opening at the Angelica and the Eleanor Bunin Monroe Film Center this Friday. The people of Rome address your character as Coriolanus, but that's not his name. This is a title that he's been given?
It's a title he wins, and it's an honorary title. His name is Caius Marcius. But in the story, he is responsible for capturing the city of Coriolis, which is a city belonging to the Volscian people.
Did they really exist?
They did, yeah. I mean, it's actually all the story of Coriolanus is ancient Roman history, and it's written up by Plutarch, and that was Shakespeare's main source for it.
Although historians have been unsure about whether Caius Marcius was a real person, what's your feeling?
I think that Plutarch's Lives, he would have thought he was writing history. We don't know what his sources were, how accurate, but somewhere along the line, he believed he was writing an account of someone who had existed. So however accurate, I would wager there was someone on who it's all based who existed.
And Coriolanus's enemy is a Volscian rebel named Aufidius, played wonderfully in the film by Gerard Butler. Can you tell us about him?
About Gerard?
Yes. Oh, Gerard Butler.
Well, yeah. Gerard is an extremely charismatic and in a great way a domineering actor who I needed someone like that to play opposite me.
To be as strong as your character.
Yes, and these are two, they're kind of like two heroes from the Iliad or something. They're like Achilles and Hector. They're high-definition warriors who have deep loathing for each other, but it goes hand in hand with the kind of fascination with each other. So this is one play of Shakespeare's where I think without question there's a strong homoerotic undercurrent between these two warriors.
And their enemies and then their friends and then...
And they want to be each other. If they're not, they have a kind of weird obsession with each other.
Now, as I understand it, you had no intention of directing this play. Are you one of those actors who doesn't want to direct? Are you one of those three actors in the world who doesn't want to direct?
Sorry, you had no idea...
I'd heard that you only directed this because you couldn't find somebody else to do it.
Is that not true?
No.
I mean, I've made sort of flip jokes about saying there was no one else rushing forward to make it. But having been in it and couldn't let go of it, felt if I was to revisit it, I'd like it to be a film. And then just thinking about it over years, I've just came up with this idea of it in a modern setting. When I pitched it to John Logan, I had a lot of images which suggested how it could be set. And then I got excited about directing it. I got really excited about... I mean, I had talked to a producer previously about directing something else that never happened. So I had felt myself going in that direction and had felt a strong curiosity, more than a curiosity, a real need to want to try to get behind the other side of the camera.
How does one learn to direct? Did you observe the directors you'd worked with in the past? You've worked with some pretty great ones, but I suspect you may have also have said to yourself at one point, if I ever direct, it's going to be a lot better than this guy is doing.
No. It's more you actually are marveling and admiring a lot of the times. Certainly I was. There's people like, Steven Spielberg, Robert Redford, Anthony Minghella, David Cronenberg, Catherine Bigelow. These are all people who are inspirational to be around when they're directing. And it's not really at all a question of I could do better. It's more like, wow, that looks great. I want to play with that toy too.
And you wound up using the same cameraman that Catherine Bigelow used.
Barry Aykroyd. Yeah, who shot the Hurt Locker.
This does have a somewhat of a feeling of Iraq.
The film?
Yes.
Yeah, well, it should feel like any of these conflicts. I mean, I think for Iraq, this is the war we've been most exposed to recently in our lives. And so it should feel like Iraq. It was also shot in Belgrade, and some people have said, is it meant to be suggestive of the Bosnian Yugoslav conflict of the early 90s? It's meant to be anywhere today, but Iraq was in my... in the production office, in my office in Belgrade, I had these many, many images from Iraq and Afghanistan on the wall.
Technology plays an important role in this film. The protesters wave camera phones at their rallies. Coriolanus seems to be constantly surrounded by the media. That's something that Shakespeare didn't think about, but that really does add to the verisimilitude of the story.
I think so. Also, having decided it's going to be today, I think you have to follow through with that. That's what happens today. People's cell phones are up immediately, and so much information is recorded and transmitted on cell phones. So that was seemed like, and it seemed, I think it right, it adds something to it.
What you don't have is the monologues.
Well, there's one or two monologues in Coriolanus, which I think he speaks, which we cut. We made a decision that we didn't want to go down the route of the monologue over the face. There is one point where we have something, a voiceover, one point only. One of the things that defines Coriolanus is the lack of introspective monologue. He has one monologue entering the enemy's city, which is more descriptive. It's quite sort of matter of fact. There's nothing like
to be or not to be,
or even some of Macbeth's in sort of self-investigative speeches.
But he is a complex character, and if anything, although he's a hero to some, he is kind of a villain. His character, he's seen as a villain by a lot of people here.
I think he's a man locked into a military way of thinking, a soldier's way of thinking in an extreme way. He can't function and negotiate in everyday circumstances.
Do you like to play characters like this? You became known in this country after you played a sadistic Nazi in Schindler's List. Mm. You played villains in Harry Potter, Red Dragon, Clash of the Titans. Is there something that attracts you to them?
Yes, but I've also played Oscar Hopkins in Oscar and Lucinda, who's a benign and slightly eccentric priest.
And you played the good guy in The Constant Gardener.
Yeah, so...
The Avengers.
Yeah. Sometimes the role designated as villain has more ambivalences and more different sort of strands and possibilities running through. But I guess I'm sort of would like to not only be identified with playing the bad guy, but ambivalent people is interesting.
Well, playing Voldemort is probably the thing that most people under a certain age would think of you
well,
as.
He's the ultimate.
Do they
bad guy.
Hiss at you when they pass you on the street?
Well, mercifully, they don't recognize me, but very rarely, because I was disfigured in the film with having no nose, which was taken off me digitally. But now, no, so...
Is that weird? You shoot the film with your nose, yeah. And then you go see a screening of the film, and you have no nose?
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to do it, but I actually was, I remember being offered it and was sort of hesitant about doing it. One of the reasons that sort of made me commit was the look, the artwork, when they showed me the design of the makeup. It looked so extraordinary and strong. I thought, that looks good. I'd like to do that.
A major part of the story involves Coriolanus's relationships with his wife and his mother. Mm. And you got some pretty good actresses for that. Vanessa Redgrave, has she ever played that part before?
No, she was the first actor I called when I had a script, and I knew I wanted her very early on. I hadn't known her for some time. But apart from one film where we were in together, we barely interacted. I hadn't worked with her, really. No, she's always moved me profoundly as a human being and as an actress. I also felt she would bring sort of endless sort of layers. She seems to have so many layers of humanity running through her on film and in the theatre. But what always moved me about the play, when I first saw it, in fact, with Ian McKellen and Irene Wirth at the National Theatre, it was the final scene, and then I understood the play. Oh, it's coming. This is why we have to watch this man ratchet up his reluctance to accommodate any kind of negotiation and is driven by his own sense of sort of narcissistic revenge, a sort of a locked figure, a kind of figure encased in his own sort of psychological armour. It's his mother that breaks him. It's his mother who's made him, who tragically humanizes him, but this humanizing of him costs him his life. And when I saw that on stage and the silence that McKellen held, in fact, it's one of the few extremely specific stage directions in Shakespeare. The mother has the long, long, long plead, the long speech, where she tries every possible way to break him down. He doesn't give in. Finally, she says something like, "You're no son of mine, you're a bastard son." And Shakespeare writes, holds her by the hand, silent. And when I saw that on stage, it was an extraordinary moment, and then he breaks. And
he doesn't give stage direction, usually.
No, it's very rare. There's usually exit, exuent, alarum.
Chased by a bear.
Yeah. Quite.
But this obviously was important for him to have...
Well, you don't know. Scholars probably... write about, and there's probably somewhere out there thinking, no, that was probably an added stage direction, but it's made it into the received, publications of Shakespeare. So it must be rooted in performance somewhere. I'd like to think it's Shakespeare's stage direction.
Vanessa Redgrave comes out of an acting family. There are a number of great acting families in England, and there are actors in your family as well. But didn't you start off thinking you'd become an artist?
I did. I left school thinking I would do a degree in fine art.
And what happened?
I went to Chelsea Art School Foundation course. Loved it. But I left a quite a traditional, very, very, very good regional grammar school.
But didn't Alan Rickman also go to Chelsea?
I think he did, yeah.
I did too. But is there something about Chelsea that leads people to become actors?
I don't know. It was just that coming from quite a traditional school, the environment of art school kind of broke you down, opened you up, made you, provoked you to be aware of all kinds of other possibilities.
You're also set to appear in Skyfall, the next installment of the James Bond series. Mm. You've been kind of secretive of the part you'll be playing. Are you going to be a good guy or a bad guy? You won't tell us?
I can't tell you. If I tell you, I'll have to kill you.
Well, you could kill me, but the whole audience would hear.
I can't comment much except to say it's classified information for the moment. But at some point, everything will be revealed.
And why would that be? What's the difference? In the end, the minute I read the review, and I'm sure you've had this experience, I'm going to know, people are going to be upset that all sorts of spoilers are in every review.
But I'm honoring the producer's wishes at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, is that it, or are you working on something else? Are you going to direct another film?
I'm hoping to direct a film about Charles Dickens and his relationship with a young actress, Ellen Ternan. Mm-hmm. It's really her story. It's called The Invisible Woman, based on a great biography by Claire Tomlin about this young actress, Ellen Ternan, who Dickens became infatuated by.
And will you be starring in that as well? Because it's one thing to direct, it's another thing to direct yourself, isn't it?
I don't know. We're having all kinds of debates about it, and I've chased a number of people, and it's in the works at the moment, but we'll see. It's a great story, though.
Meanwhile, this film, based on Shakespeare's Coriolanus, opens this Friday at two theaters, at the Angelica downtown and in the Lincoln Center area, the Eleanor Bunin Monroe Film Center, a new film center that's quite wonderful. Thank you so much, Ray Fiennes.
Thank you, Leonard. Thank you.